Accession number 31683, Reel 1.
Liz Stevens, Reel 1. If we could start with when and where you were born.
I was born in a place called, spell it for you carefully, C-A-L-V-E-R-L-E-Y, in what was then the West Riding of Yorkshire. I think they've called it something else now, of Yorkshire.
When was this?
Well, I'm older than my husband. I was born in March 18th of March 1918. I have 5 months, I think, or 6 months or something, older than him. That's all that.
And you grew up at in Carverley?
Well, I went, I finished my education, not at Carverley. I went up to Oxford and I left school. And just when I wanted, had finished 1939, to go adventuring as one wished to, the war broke out. So I had to go away to the war instead. And that was 6 years gone, you know. Just when you want to go do exciting things. Well, I suppose war was exciting in a way.
Before we come on to that, how had you found life in Yorkshire growing up?
Oh, it was a village I was brought up in, and my father's family had lived there since 1268. So, you know, it was pretty astonishing, really. I mean, imagine staying in one place all that long. Anyway, they had. And I don't know, we had friends, we had quite a nice time. I went to school in Bradford, and it's still a very academic school, the grammar school there. In fact, in those league tables, the government used to put out a sort of head of Eton once in the Premier League, very academic sort of school, and had a very high standard. And that was all, really. It was nice, the village, but I wasn't there much after I left school. In fact, I never was, because by the time my education was finished, the war broke out. So I went away to the wars, more or less, and that was that.
Had you enjoyed school?
Oh, yes. I was head of the school, as it happened. I enjoyed it. I mean, I had plenty of friends, and I enjoyed learning. I was had sort of a lot of curiosity, I suppose, so I enjoyed learning. Mm-hmm.
Any particular favourite subjects?
Well, I think I liked English literature best, but I quite liked, added German and Latin and French, and quite liked that. We had a remarkable Latin teacher. She was passionate about the classics, and she was very peculiar looking, so you know what school children are. But she was a real teacher, and not that it's done me any good in later life, she went to lengths of setting Horace's odes to music so we'd get the meter right. And although I can't say it's done me much good in later life, I couldn't get them wrong. That's teaching, I suppose, isn't it? Anyway, I'm sure that's not of interest to anybody.
What did your parents do?
I don't know, really. My mother was Scot, and her, that side of the family were textile manufacturers. And then my grandfather invented Viola, you know. You've heard of Viola. And he had two factories in Paisley, textile mills. One brought, he was dyeing and finishing, which soft water area like where we live. And he did Harris Street at one and Viola at the other. And as we had to wear Viola shirts at school, my mother got the Viola free and had them made well in the winter. And that's all. My father, he didn't really seem to do anything much. He sort of ran the village, but I don't know. I really couldn't tell you what he did. I never really inquired. He was a well-known person round about 6'7". My poor grandparents, you know, had this big family, and the smallest was 6 feet tall. So I don't know how they managed.
Had you any brothers or sisters?
I had a sister, yes. She died young. She got TB, and although by then they had streptomycin and all these things, it killed her, really. She didn't, in fact, I brought her up here and she died, not this house, that house down there. No, we were in Glasgow, what am I talking about? We built that house down there originally, it got too big and the garden got too big. I don't know how old she was, but it was very sad, because you'd think they could have cured it. It ran in the family, or I don't think it runs in families, but people living in this, it's very infectious. Is that the right word? Infectious. Not contagious, but infectious. And they used to think it was ran in families, but it's just very infectious. And of course it doesn't show itself right away, so... Anyway, there you are. That's my sister. Accounted for. She didn't live to a 90, but like I am. 90, imagine.
Had you any particular career in mind as you were?
Well, yes, I thought, I don't know, I just thought I'd like to be a journalist. I was going to be the greatest war correspondent on earth, but instead I went into the army.
Was that something your parents had encouraged, journalism?
No, they didn't. They did, they'll just do as we wished, very much. I don't say we were sort of spoiled, I think, but we were very much left to make our own decisions.
How much had you been aware of the situation in Europe during the 1930s?
Well, quite a bit. I really was. First of all, there was a Spanish Civil War, if you remember, and I used to work for some organisation that sent milk out to Spain. And then I was very aware that things were going wrong. You could hardly help being if you're not insane, or, you know. It's obviously going to be trouble. But I thought, you could write this down. I read All Quiet on the Western Front and Journey's End in my teens. And I thought, I was so relieved. I felt nobody ever again could be so stupid as to start another war. Just when I was finished my education and ready to go adventuring. Well, I suppose it was an adventure, but being in the war, but it wasn't what I'd have chosen.
What was your reaction then to the declaration of war?
Well, I just thought I'd have to go away to the wars, and I did. Because that was 1939, and I'd finished my education. And you can't do much else when there's a war, can you? And I thought it was silly, but I thought we'd better win. Everybody had better go who could. Couldn't think of Hitler being over here, you know, stamping about in those silly knickerbockers. Couldn't.
How did you get yourself involved then?
How do you mean? I just volunteered to go away to the. Well, I thought I'd go. If you want to know, I you know, girls have silly reasoning. I suppose I was calling myself a girl. I thought, well, the Wrens look very smart in their navy blue, and the Air Force, the Waffs look very smart in their pale. I'll have the khaki. Does nothing for you. You know, I'll get khaki. So I went into the army. Does nothing for you, I can tell you.
When was this?
Well, just at the start of war. And I was commissioned quite soon, really. But before, I was in this anti-aircraft battery, where, as I say, we got attacked by the IRA in Ireland. I thought that was dreadfully. But they did, they came all guns blazing. They didn't do any good. I mean, they just made a fuss and then went away. And we discovered, this is typical of the army in a way, but he's really very efficient, don't misunderstand me. He's much more efficient than people think. We had the big guns, you know, they had to have an aiming point. Every morning they had to be lined up. It always amused me. They sent a courier on a motorbike with the barometric pressure for the day. As if the Germans couldn't find it out for themselves. I said, see, it had to be decoded. I ask you. And anyway, the guns, for all the great big heavy things, you know, I mean, bow and arrow stuff today, they were affected by the weather, you know, slightly off if the barometric pressure went up or down. So this chap hurtled out on his motorbike with this piece of paper to be decoded. I don't know whether to keep that secret.
What was the... Just to go back a little bit, what was the process for after you joined it for training? And
oh, heavens, you're asking for the other. Well, I had to go. The nearest place, Newcastle, and it had 3 weeks training as being in the army. Then we went away into a ACAC regiment and learned about the guns and things. The men fired the guns, and they had a lot of equipment which we looked after, you know. You had, sounds a bit long-winded, they, with all these facts and figures and various machines which gave us some height, bearing, angle and all the rest of it, they all had to be worked out on what to, it sounds very, very, it wasn't high-tech at all, it wouldn't be now, because we have heated missiles and all that, don't we? Guided missiles, rather. And we had to work this out and then give the fuse to the men that put the shells into the hole and pulled whatever they did. Hardly pulled the trigger with things like that. Anyway, they fired them. And big noise they made as well. Oh, I never liked noise. Now I'm going to go into an anti-aircraft battery. Very well. And then I was commissioned. And I became an admin ATS officer, and that was boring too. Wars are boring, you know. Very. I mean, we sat about all the time on this gun site, and pandemonium with a red alert. Then you sit about, I mean, you wouldn't find the guns all the time, and it was very boring, I can assure you. Got through lots of books. And the only interesting thing that ever happened to me on the gun park. There was a thing called the control room, which was underground, and two ATS were in it all night, one night. One was could sleep, and one could sit up. And fortunately, well, I never thought of going to sleep when the girl was asleep, but they rang you up and read a thing at dictation speed and then asked you to read it back in the morning. That was just to make sure somebody was awake, you know. And I was down enlisting one night, and it was my turn to go to sleep. And I found this girl unconscious, and we had one of these coke-burning stoves. So it was just as well I did sit up. You know, the effects are heavy. The heavy fumes that come out of them, they go down. And fortunately, I was up, you know. So I opened the door and got her out, and she came too. But that's a silly little thing to remember, but I do. And as I say, when I was commissioned, I had a company, eventually had a company of girls in my charge. I found a photograph of them the other day. I didn't remember I had it. And there we are, all these girls. And I was at a place called Castle Ashby, and you know, it is a castle. It's the Northamptonshire seat of the Marquess of Northampton, who I must say was a very good landlord to the army. And it must have broken his heart. He had this beautiful park in front of the castle. And it became a vehicle maintenance depot. And a friend of mine had a tank maintenance school there. And it was completely ruined. But I gather I learnt. My husband was down there once, a few years after the end of the war. It had all been put back. It was a beautiful. I mean, it was awful. It was ornamental lakes, and you know. But he didn't ever complain. He, Spencer, you may have heard, you know, the Spencers. He was very opposite. He was asked to let the army. And they came, and he didn't like it, and he got all the brass hats from the wall and stuff and threw them out. Now, that wasn't very patriotic, was it? But there you are. But not put that anywhere. I'll probably miss you for libel or slander, is it, when you say it? I don't know.
How long had you been stationed in Belfast for, then?
Well, it wasn't in Belfast. We were outside. They'd got a... I can't remember. It wasn't too long ago. But then I went from there. We went from there down to the south coast of England. And we were in a sort of very... up in the hills behind Belfast. And you weren't really allowed to go into Belfast, in certain parts of Belfast, in uniform. You said, you don't go there, let me come out again, you know. And but, so we didn't. It was... I don't know how long we were there, really. I went away... When we got down to the south coast of England, well, of course, there was a good deal of action. I left to go to Oxford and be commissioned, so I don't know where they went after that. And then I was just an admin officer and had all these girls to look after. And when you think about it, you know, we're all young or youngish, and yet at that age, to have 200 girls you're responsible for is quite a responsibility, isn't it, when you think about it? Well, I mean, I was in my 20s, all right, but... But everybody was young, of course, when they were in the army, weren't they? Mm-hmm. Anything further you'd like to know?
How much action were, when you were outside of Belfast, how much anti-aircraft action were you...
Hardly at all. You see, as I say, it was a very boring sort of job. It was pandemonium if you were firing the guns. Otherwise, you'd just nothing to do. And so they made things for you to do, like going for route marches or cross-country runs or something, but basically it was very boring. I think a lot of the things in the army must have been... I mean, everybody wasn't fighting desperate battles all the time, were they? It was very boring, I suppose, for everybody. I don't know how long I was there. As I say, went down... That was a very efficient move. You know, people think the army's a terrible muddle, but it isn't really. It's much more efficient than people think. This whole regiment, we set off at 3 o'clock in the morning, walking or marching, whatever you like to call it, to the camp, which was good long way from Belfast, in the dark, you know. And we all got on this boat, and it was... Everything went like clockwork. And we didn't know where... You never knew where you were going, of course, and there were no place names anywhere. Although, I suppose it could get odd and survey maps, the Germans would still, if they wanted to find out where they were. But the whole thing went like clockwork, you know. The only thing that... Well, trouble was they... I mean, there's lots of people in a regiment, and a whole train. And for, apart from a cat we had with kittens... that escaped onto the railway line. We were all down on our knees, including the battery major, who was extremely fat, trying to get this cat out and these kittens out from under the stationary train. It all went like clockwork, and I don't think the army allows for that. But it was a place, Belfast, I imagine, you wouldn't like to have been in, except in a very... I was in Belfast on a day off, and that chap... Oh, I've forgotten his name, a member of the IRA, held a whole cinema, you know, gunpoint and lectured them. And I was thinking of going to see that film. I told them, I'm sorry, I missed it. But, you know, they were quite active. Those baddies, well, they still are, aren't they?
What was your experience then of relations between the population in Belfast and the British troops?
Well, they seemed to be all right, but I tell you, who weren't the Welsh. They were extremely hostile. And we were training us on Anglesey for firing, because you had to have some sea, you know, to fire over. And this intrepid pilot dragged this target across the sky. I think he should have been awarded the VC, because the firing's very erratic when you first start, you know. And it wasn't very far from the aeroplane, this thing we were firing at. And in Wales, in Anglesey, they were extremely hostile. Started speaking Welsh as soon as you went into the shops and pretended they couldn't speak English, you know. I don't know why, because we didn't want to be there. And he said, so what do you think we went there? You're very much mistaken. But the Welsh are a funny lot. They're little black people, you know, the Welsh. Well, that's all I know about them, really. I shouldn't say that. They're probably very nice, really. But they were distinctly hostile. Funny enough, wasn't it? I mean, there we were, trying to protect them, you know. or we're going to, but no. They didn't like us.
When the IRA attacked you that time, how many were there?
Well, I have no idea. They seemed to be a lot of gunfire. But I don't know how they came, but they made a big noise. And I don't know how many IRA were there, but it sounded like a lot of shots were fired. Nobody got hit, and they went away in the dark. But we found this close aiming point for the gun. It was a barn, and it was an IRA arms store. I suppose we shot it then, shell into it by mistake. Someone got carried away. And gone up with a bang, wasn't it? And it was, I suppose, a funny thing to be in the army and have a few people there that weren't on your side and in your own country, which we were. Say, well, that's all foolish.
It was after that then that the Ulster Constabulary were.
Sorry?
It was after that incident that the Ulster Constabulary were.
We had to have this, as I say, Ulster Constabulary with a machine gun and very unarmoured car, in other words, with a machine gun defending us. We were supposed to be defending them. I don't know. Less and less.
Would you be able to explain the process of actually required to actually fire the anti-air?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was quite straightforward. He had a thing called a control room underground, and that had a special line, and we also had radio in there, so that if there was, well, you'd know there was a red alert, you got that first, you see, so everybody got into position, and aircraft came your way, you fired. But it was a long, boring time, you know, when you weren't firing. It was not like a battle. It had been a battle, I should think. It had been less boring. And I mean, it was called the Battle of Britain, wasn't it, when that was a battle for the aircraft. But it was just boring, you know. We once, for sure, I know, shot a German plane down. You didn't know, really, because if a lot of batteries firing, no one ever knew really who had done it. But our brigadier got a bit carried away, and the fighters were supposed to be up, and he told us to fire. And actually, we did, because we saw it happen. We were the only battery firing, so we must have done it this, and it came down. And I felt awful for a minute, those poor young men burning to death. And then I thought, oh, well, their bombs would have done more damage. So you have to be pragmatic in wartime. It's a thought, though, isn't it? Knowing you and a few others were responsible for it. Well, all of us, really, because we don't know who. We all did it, and the guns fired, but they shouldn't have done. I don't suppose anything happened to the brigadier. He had a great influence on me. He was a very handsome man, and he had a beautiful army greatcoat lined with scarlet satin. And I thought, well, if I'm ever commissioned, I'll have a greatcoat lined with scarlet satin, and I did. But they were so heavy you could never wear them. Very, very heavy. Well, they great gauntlets, double-breasted, a pleat all the way down the back, a double pleat all the way down the back. They really weren't possible to wear. You just had to fling them about and all sorts of things. So show my satin lining off. Oh, dear.
When was it then that you were commissioned?
I've no idea of the date. Just not very long after I was in. Well, I was. No, it's not true. I was a year, I think, or just over a year in the gun sight, and then I went away to be commissioned. So I was only doing any actual firing of guns for a year, just over a year, I think. And I don't know. It was a boring life in the army, on the whole. You can write that down.
How did you find the domestic side of things in terms of the quarters and rations and so on?
When I was in the ranks. It's a long time ago, you know. Well, I'm not a fussy eater. We were all tin huts, you know, on a side. And the food wasn't brilliant. I can't remember, really. The one thing was good, the training place where we trained, they had a bakery on the camp, and they made their own bread, and it was very nice, I remember. That I do remember. Could smell these. And if you were doing a fire picket, you walked around the camp all night, I suppose to see if a fire broke out, and you could smell this bakery getting going, more the smell of baking bread in the early hours in the morning. I do remember that. Yes. But the food wasn't. I'm not fussy. The men were much more fussy than the women about food. Oh, they were terrible. By the time I was commissioned, a newly commissioned officer is always given the worst job, which is a catering officer. I got it. Newly coming to a unit, no one likes the job, and because I got it, and the waste that went on, and I went into this food store. And up to the ceiling, it was flour and things that nobody wanted much. And I thought, well, if there's this much flour, why isn't there this much butter and margarine and bacon and meat, you know? So I got the catering corporal and I said, what's all this about? Shouldn't there be more? And he got into a slight fluster. And I got shortly after, got a letter from someone where he lived to say, did I know one of our men was flogging, you know, on the black market, flogging this food to be provided for the army. Anyway, he was caught out. But, you know, it's only human nature. You find it all over, don't you? All about us. But still, he was not a very pleasant individual. And he got his comeuppance, I'm glad to say. And I don't think anything else exciting happened except I thought we had a murder. The police thought we had a murder. And it was a girl, one of the girls, she was a bit a poor pathetic thing, really. And the worst of it was that nobody wanted her body. I thought it was terrible. She was in the cookhouse and the police thought she'd been murdered because there were ornamental lakes there, you couldn't get drowned in her, but she was apparently drowned in her, and they weren't deep enough. I mean, you couldn't drown unless you sort of, well, you couldn't, in other words, you'd just come to the top and start breathing when you got conscious again. So there was a great uproar about this, and they said, well, you'll have to deal with the body. And I wrote her address, and her grandparents lived there, and they didn't want her, we don't want her. What would you do with the body? So I said, well, I'm afraid you'd have to have her. And we had to buy a coffin, and I had to escort it, this coffin up to Newcastle. It was very sad, I mean, in a way, but people were getting killed all over. But the priest didn't follow it up. I suppose worse things were happening all about. But nobody wanted her. I thought that was very pathetic, didn't you? Nobody wanting her. Out in the body. Poor girl. Anyway, that's all I know about murder in the army. Murder. As opposed to people getting killed by enemy fire. And what else do I know about it? The army. So long ago.
Did that incident have any effect on everyone else's morale?
Not at all. No one seemed to get up. Well, I suppose it was a war, you know, and the worst things were happening all about. What I did think was funny, was when we got the V1s, you know, these rockets, and they were silly. They were actually silly. They came so slowly. It took a little while to get the RAF to get onto it, and the gun sight, you know, gun fires. But they could be just tipped out of the sky, But he had to make sure it didn't fall down on anything that mattered. And I was sitting in Peter Jones's, having my hair permed, because you've got to have tidy hair in the army, on the top floor, old glass, and big buildings, got what was called, when these things were going, got the an imminent danger warning. It meant it was coming over the top. And everybody fled to the cellar. But in those days, your perm, you were fixed up to the machine, you see. I like the posters on the burning deck. And I sat there all alone on the top floor. And this thing, it was coming down, went right past my eyes. And I saw it take a street up, not very far away. That was seconds off death, isn't it? I mean, it was seconds. That was a narrow squeak, wasn't it? But they weren't very, very efficient, these things. But I still somehow, I remember the sound of them. And some things, some of the machines I hear, I said, oh, I don't know the noise. And they were